You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Hello everyone, I'm Dr. Shilpa Gupta. I'm a GU medical oncologist and the leader of the GU medical oncology program at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, USA. It is an honor for me to be joined by my colleagues and friends, Dr. Helen Moon and Dr. Srikala Sridhar, to record this podcast on platinum eligibility and treatment sequencing in platinum eligible patients with locally advanced or metastatic urothelial cancer. Dr. Moon, Dr. Sridhar, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Thank you. So I'm Helen Moon. I'm a medical oncologist based out of Southern California, and I'm with Kaiser Permanente, and currently I am the GU lead for the country, and I'm the research lead for GU down in Southern California.
Thank you, Shilpa. My name is Kala Shidara. I'm a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto. I'm the lead of the GU Medical Oncology Site Group and as well lead of the GU Medical Oncologists of Canada. Thanks for having me.
This is really going to be a very interactive session, and we want to talk about defining platinum eligibility for patients with locally advanced or metastatic urothelial cancer and treatment sequencing in these patients. As you know, the landscape has changed so rapidly. And I want to highlight here that the treatment options will vary in different countries depending on what is the treatment options available there. So that can be affected by the local considerations.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think we more and more aware of what's happening on an international stage and how things are different across different countries. So maybe I'll start with the first question. And this is really, why is it important to discuss platinum eligibility and treatment sequencing in patients with locally advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma? So maybe I'll ask Helen to address that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you two have both alluded to, this area is changing so quickly that sometimes I wonder if a year from now we will be having the same conversation. But we do know that locally advanced and metastatic urothelial carcinoma, which we'll talk about as advanced urothelial carcinoma, has a really poor prognosis, right? And five-year survival for decades has been around a little bit less than 10%, about 8%. And we also know that this type of cancer is extremely sensitive to platinum-based chemotherapy, which has been our standard of care, certainly in the U.S., and I would say probably globally for over two decades, probably going on three decades. But the issue had been eligibility. For eligible patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma, they have much better outcome than patients who are determined to not be. So that determination of platinum eligibility really helps identify those potential treatment options. Recently, though, just to talk about what an exciting time it is in bladder cancer, EV-302 reported out. It's really the first-line treatment with a non-platinum agent, in this case, enfortumab plus pembrolizumab, that resulted in considerable improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. I think all three of us were really taken back by the data at ESMO just last year. And this is compared to the gold standard now for decades, which is platinum chemotherapy. And we should see that more and more coming through as a first-line option. This was given FDA approval, I think, just a few months ago, and it's certainly a new standard of care in the United States. But as you've talked about, we're talking about the rest of the world also. I believe the Europeans are meeting in the summer of 2024 to discuss this. I'm not sure what the situation is in Canada. Maybe you can let us know that. However, even with these really impressive overall survival and progression-free survival numbers, EV plus Pembro is... it got toxicity. It's got a very distinct toxicity profile, which includes things that we don't normally have seen for years with bladder cancer, such as skin reactions, hyperglycemia, and the big thing that we all talk about, which is neuropathy, right? So in this patient population, which tends to be older, they may be vasculopathic, they may have all the risk factors for neuropathy. Peripheral neuropathy is a very common treatment-related adverse event, and that can be cumulative. And what we see more and more, they're permanent. So you may not ever regain those pre-treatment nerves, if you will, right? So because of this, the patient's ability to keep receiving the same drug if it's working or getting subsequent lines could be compromised. So even as enfortumab plays a larger and larger role in the treatment of locally advanced and metastatic bladder cancer, we cannot forget platinum because it still has a very important role. So because of this, you know, a lot of us discuss sequencing is EV up plus pembro up front versus a platinum, you know, depending on the toxicity of the patients. And I think it's a worthwhile conversation. And even though this is primarily a medical conversation, I think cost is also significant. You know, these are all very expensive drugs, and they work. So that cost piece more and more is figuring into the conversation. We're here in the United States where patients may be asked to cost share if there is significant infusion co-pays that they may be responsible for, or how it may limit usage in other part of the world, whereas a more centralized healthcare system make the decision whether or not they can afford these drugs. So having said all of that, we still are talking about platinum-based chemotherapy because it's expected to remain a very important treatment option, even as EV plus pembro comes into play. Okay. And where later lines of therapy, later lines of options, what if it's just not available in your country? Those are the reasons why we may still be talking about that. Platinum-based chemotherapy is also a second-line treatment. So if you've received EV plus pembro upfront, you may see this conversation again a few months to a year from now. Although, and the other thing that we've seen certainly during the summer of 2023 is platinum shortages, right? And this is speaks to a bigger problem that as medications, which are life-saving, are generic, they're more susceptible, I think, to the vagaries of production, of marketplace access. So there are all of these things that play into why this conversation today is still relevant.
Yeah, I think you've raised some really important points just relating to access to these treatments. And, you know, to your question, in Canada, we're hoping for maybe the beginning of the fall to see access to EV plus pembro. But again, we really don't know exact timelines. And then the next piece, of course, in Canada will be the funding piece. So certainly, you know, there will be differences around the world in terms of when access comes into play. And things like platinum have been around a long time, which means that there's a lot of familiarity with these drugs. So I agree with you. I think they will be around for a little bit of time yet to come.
Yeah, you know, I also think that now that we know that we're still going to have to be playing with platinum for many years to come, I think. So for that patient with advanced urothelial carcinoma, what criteria do you, when we say clinicians, do you, Shilpa, or do you, Kala, use when you're determining eligibility for that platinum chemotherapy?
That was a great start in discussion. So I think, you know, I agree with you, Helen and Kala, that platinums are here to stay. You know, even on EV-302 patients who had progressed on IV pembro, platinums is what they received as second line. And, you know, we don't have any other data of what they received right after EV pembro. But I would say that the choice of treatment is informed by whether a patient historically used to be cisplatin eligibility, right? So whether a patient is eligible for cisplatin or not, but if a patient is ineligible for cisplatin, whether they are eligible for carboplatin-based therapy, which around 50% of our patients are ineligible for cisplatin. And then there's this category of whether they are ineligible for even carboplatin-based chemotherapy or unsuitable for any treatment whatsoever. And the whole category of platinum ineligibility stemmed from the FDA's restriction of label for single-agent pembrolizumab and atezo for frontline treatment of patients with cisplatin ineligibility, and later on, it became only restricted to platinum-ineligible patients. And on an average, our patients are older than patients with other cancers and have several comorbidities. When considering platinum-based chemotherapy, it becomes very relevant. And the criteria for cisplatin eligibility have been defined since 2011 by Galsky et al., which was from an international survey of bladder cancer experts. And this criteria uses the benchmarks of ECOG performance status 2 or higher, creatinine clearance less than 60 mL per minute, grade 2 or higher neuropathy, and significant heart failure and hearing loss grade 2. And any one of these criteria deems a patient ineligible to receive cisplatin. And based on the clinical experience with cisplatin-based chemotherapy in the real world, and Carla, you've done work on this, creatinine clearance of 50 is more practically used and not really 60. And then there's strategies we can use like split dosing of cisplatin. So I think for the modern world, it is 50 and not really 60. And patient perspectives on potential positive and negative effects of treatment can also affect these. And like I said, this is what we've been doing for cisplatin ineligible patients for a long time now. And whether a patient is eligible to receive carboplatin or not, we did a survey with around 60 medical oncologists in the US who treat bladder cancer, and came up with a consensus criteria of really very frail patients. The bar was really low. For example, performance status of 3 or higher, creatinine clearance less than 30, peripheral neuropathy grade 2 or higher, and significant heart failure. So I would say that, those are the patients you have to really evaluate whether they are fit for anything. And but in our practice, it's only 10% of patients who are totally unfit for any platinum.
Yeah, I think that's very fair comments. I think this assessment of cisplatin eligibility is important and has been important for years and years because platinum, of course, has been our standard frontline treatment for a long time. I think we're much better at giving cisplatin now than we were maybe 20 years ago, or maybe even when the Galski criteria were first created. We do things like added hydration. We check the magnesium levels. And then we can, as you mentioned, also adjust the dose a little bit. Split dose, for example, makes it easier for patients. Day 1 and 8 is the same, especially for their antiemetic regimens. They remain the same as well. So I think there's a number of factors involved in terms of addressing their eligibility for cisplatin or carboplatin, which you recently also, gave us some criteria around as well, which helps us to determine who should be getting cis, who should be getting carbo, and who should maybe not be getting any platinum-based chemotherapy.
Thank you. That's a really great discussion. Helen, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think you guys all make a great point. In before we had EV, we wanted to give platinum, right? And how we are able to give it, and there's certainly the thought for many years that cisplatin is more potent, has more activity in this space. And just like what Kala said, between hydration and cisplatin, I've given it quite low for creatinine clearance, even closer to 40, that back when there was no other option. So I think we've gotten much better at doing this.
Yeah. And for our next question is just a natural follow-up of this discussion. For patients who are eligible for platinums, how do you go around deciding which platinum to offer and what regimen? There's this whole thing about Gemcis or dose-dense MVAC, and a lot of people have switched to Gemcis in metastatic setting. I would love to hear from you, Carla, what your what processes for these platinum eligible patients?
Sure. So, I mean, for my patients, I tend to be somewhat of a Gemcis type person. I've used a lot of Gemcis. I feel very comfortable using Gemcis. My feeling is if the disease is going to respond to platinum, I don't think there's going to be a big difference between Gemcis and dose-dense MVAC. And both are recommended as per level one evidence. And of course, for those who are cisplatin ineligible, and of course, the criteria is a little bit more liberal than it used to be. I too use a creatinine clearance of 50 in most of my patients. I look at something like gemcitabine and carboplatin would be a choice. And certainly in those who have a response to that, go on to receive maintenance of elimab as per the JAVELIN study. We know that real-world studies and surveys have reported that use of cisplatin in clinical practice is actually lower than predictions based on eligibility, with eligible patients sometimes receiving carboplatin or immunotherapy, indicating that some of these treatment guidelines are not universally followed. And I think some of this comes down to the experience of the physicians. Are they treating many bladder cancers in a year, or are they just treating a few here and there? what's the comfort level? And certainly, you know, they're concerned about tolerability. It may also depend on what other cancers they treat and what drugs they're used to using in those other settings. Patient comorbidities are important. Patient preferences are important, and as well, access to affordable healthcare. Cisplatin-based chemotherapy is generally considered more efficacious than carboplatin-based chemotherapy for patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma. And if you take a look at all of the studies, you tend to see those who are treated with cisplatin tend to do just a little bit better, even if they're not directly compared head-to-head. But patients who are ineligible for cisplatin typically have a worse performance status and worse prognostic characteristics associated with a shorter survival. So there's some confounding factors as well. We know in some countries, an alternative option for cisplatin-ineligible patients with PD-L1 positive tumors is the immune checkpoint inhibitors monotherapy with, say, for example, pembrolizumab or atezolizumab, although these are no longer approved in this setting in the U.S. And I think we have to be careful because platinum-based chemotherapy, despite all its problems, has fairly respectable response rates, and some of those response rates are coming in higher than single-agent IO. And I know there's a lot of pressure to use IO, and some of that is coming from our patients, but I think it's important that we stay true to the data we have around platinum-based chemotherapy. In the U.S., EV plus Pembro is recommended and already approved initially in the cisplatin-ineligible group, and more recently has been approved in the cisplatin-eligible group as well. And also in the frontline setting, we've seen the results from the sub-study of the CheckMate 901 trial, and this is a really interesting trial that enrolled patients who are only cisplatin-eligible. The thinking here is that combining cisplatin and immunotherapy may do better or have better outcomes than combining carboplatin and immunotherapy. So that formed the basis for this trial. This is a first-line treatment with nivolumab plus cisplatin-based chemotherapy, followed by nivolumab monotherapy. And this resulted in significantly longer progression-free survival and overall survival compared with cisplatin-based chemotherapy alone. And that's nivolumab plus cisplatin-based chemotherapy really has the potential to become an additional first-line treatment option. And I believe that it just got FDA approval in the U.S. as well. And the efficacy of this combination has not directly been compared with cisplatin-based chemotherapy followed by avelumab maintenance. However, there were some patients who did go on to receive in the standard arm avelumab maintenance. And its role in countries where EV plus pembrolizumab is available is really less clear. Shilpa, did you want to comment?
You summed it up very well. And I think, you know, in the real world, we actually looked at this and published it that, you know, unnecessarily patients are deemed platinum ineligible when they could easily receive gemcarbo followed by avelumab maintenance, which, you know, that is the recommended standard of care has been. And patients with single-agent immunotherapy don't do well when they can actually get gemcarbo. So it's very important to recognize that only about 10% patients are those who won't be able to get carboplatin because it's not more than that.
Right, fair. And so then leading into our next question, so what criteria do clinicians use to determine if patients are ineligible for platinum-based chemotherapy? And this really highlights some of the work that you've done recently, Shilpa.
Yeah, and you know, just to build on what we were discussing, that the platinum ineligibility space stemmed back in 2018 when the FDA restricted the label of immunotherapy for frontline setting. So we did a survey and updated it in 2022, where we also included, you know, different criteria, including age, creatinine clearance, performance status, peripheral neuropathy, hearing loss, and anything else that people had, and then fine-tuned it and then added the data with the maintenance avelumab to see what are people actually using. And based on the consensus, you know, with the limitations of that, the conclusion was that anybody with a performance status of 3 or higher, creatinine clearance less than 30, grade 2 or higher, peripheral neuropathy, class 3 or worse, heart failure. And, you know, in the combination of performance status 2, also creatinine clearance of less than 30, we asked this particular question because in the EORTC 30986 study, patients with ECOG performance status 2, those who got carboplatin and had creatinine clearance less than 60 did really poorly. You know, median survival was just 6 to 8 months. So when we asked that question, instead of 60, 30 was still the cutoff. So this is just a guidance for people to use at the point of care and also to develop clinical trials for this patient population. And one such trial is actually ongoing with building on that atezolizumab backbone. And similar criteria are also included in the EAU guidelines. So I think there's uniform agreement on the most part for when not to use any platinum.
Sounds good. Helen, any comments?
I think in this space, no, but just globally, I think you guys brought up this really great point, which is for years, bladder cancer patients tend to be older, tend to be more frail, sometimes sicker. And what we see, the biggest barrier is actually that first team that evaluate them, whether that's a hospitalist, an internist, a urologist, had deemed that they are not healthy enough to even consider more therapy. So it's the people that don't walk through the door that actually worry about more than people who do walk through the door. Because if you truly look at the definition, what's both published and what we commonly used, a good amount of people could get treatment and could get platinum chemotherapy. And yet, when we look at the real world correlation, we know that probably just a little bit more than half is offered, where it probably should be much more in the majority. So those are really kind of what I worry more about. But yeah, when I think about patients who are not eligible for platinum, truly not eligible for platinum chemotherapy, those are patients who are obviously the kidney function you think about, right? That's a very black and white type of a scenario. But you also think about their functional status if they're just really just too frail to come and do through the rigor of chemotherapy. And in that very limited space, and I gotta say, I can only think of maybe 10, 20%, even though the real world data really suggests something like 40% of these patients are offered, essentially it would be immunotherapy as monotherapy. And what we know is that, there's country to country differences. So here I'm speaking about the US, that pembrolizumab and atezolizumab are potential options here, again, in the United States. And these are done from two fairly modest trials, phase two trials, subgroup analysis that show that there is benefit, and right, and the FDA had given that approval and have not removed it, so we are still able to do this in the United States. I mean, presumably, if they cannot get platinum, things like enfortumab could be thought about. But I would really say that if it's due to functional status is the reason that they cannot get platinum, I cannot imagine that they would be eligible for enfortumab, which is an equally, I think, potent, though different type of toxic drug, right? But if you go by label, EV plus pembro is definitely there also as an option. But I would really reserve those for patients who are somewhat borderline, primarily on the kidney function and not because of a functional issue. Patients who are really ineligible for any platinum chemo overall tend to be more frail. And a lot of times those conversations, rightly so, talk about goals of care, palliative care, and so on. And really my last point would be that bladder cancer patients, because the bladder with the urine, there's frequent infections. I've had seen patients in the hospital really look terrible because they're dealing with urosepsis or pain or difficulty from not being able to sleep because all the bladder irritation. And if the right antibiotics, the right supportive care is given, sometimes a week or two later, they look pretty darn good, right? With nephrostomy tubes and so on. So if with full-throated supportive care, they're still really looking frail, I think it's incumbent upon us to really discuss goals of care. But I think there really should be an effort to try to right the ship, if you will. As always, this is an area that we don't have that many great options. So prospective trials focusing on these patients are truly warranted and desired in this group.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. That was a great segue to the next question for patients not eligible for any platinum chemotherapy. What would you recommend? And you alluded to the fact that pembro and atezo are options, although in the US, atezo has been withdrawn. You also mentioned about supportive care. Any other thoughts in your practice? What percentage are you offering single agent immunotherapy to? And how would you, sometimes it's just the eyeball test, right? This patient can't really tolerate even platinum. And I agree with you, in that patient, I would be very hesitant to offer EV Pembro because if they can't tolerate carboplatin, I think it's needless to say they can't tolerate EV unless they were like an ECOG performance status zero who just because of the disease has become just so rapidly kind of deteriorated. But anything else you want to add to this options for patients who are truly platinum ineligible?
No, I think thank you for asking this question. I think I pre-answered it, but you know, a lot of the points that I made, but I think that last bit, and this was particularly brought home to me that the last time I'm on call, there was a patient newly diagnosed bladder cancer, lymph nodes, blockage. I mean, looked really very, very ill. And at the time that I was called in to consult with him, and he really kind of insisted on it, you know, the hospital's urologist really kind of indicated that his best option is hospice, right? But yet with percutaneous tubes, antibiotics, 2 weeks later, he looked pretty darn good. And I think we just have to really respect the fact that this can turn around quickly and do our due diligence so that that first look is not the only look we give when we're talking about the eyeball test.
And Helen, in your experience, like you said, patients who show up at our door, they can get something, right? So how often do you offer hospice to these patients who are coming to your doorstep? Because I don't think I've seen any such patients, maybe one or two a year, where they're not even good enough for single agent immuno.
I think if they make it through my doorstep, my experience is very similar. It's rare. And usually it's because they're either on the extremes of age or there's something that because of the healthcare system, they didn't get to my door in time, right? But overall, that's really rare. In the hospital, if you take an inpatient call, which probably we all do, you do see it here and there. But just like you, I've got to be talking about one to two cases a year at most. So when I see numbers in the real world that's kind of deem a good swatch of our patients platinum ineligible, I really wonder if they're getting that type of care that we would want for them. Jumping onto that, so let's say now you have this patient walking through the door. You think, okay, I can't offer you treatment, right? And you went ahead and offered platinum-based treatment because, again, that's what we were doing for so many years. And they have disease control at that point. What is the recommended approach that you currently do? So you gave your platinum. Usually, we give what, 4 to 6 doses. You scan. You have disease control. What is that conversation like at this point, Colin?
Sure. So happy to discuss that. So, we know a large proportion of patients do have a response to upfront platinum-based chemotherapy, and I think that's an awfully good place to be, an important thing for our patients. And once they have a response, then we think about maintenance of avelumab, which is really based on the JAVELIN study. And when I say response, I mean a patient's had complete response, partial response, or stable disease after 4 to 6 cycles of treatment. And I'll be honest, I'm tending to give a little bit more 4 cycles than 6 cycles because I worry about the cumulative neuropathy that can happen not only with platinum, but also with subsequent treatments like, for example, EV that we currently use in the third line setting. So in patients with an upfront response to treatment, I do follow up with the maintenance of avelumab. And there's about, I'd say about 70% or so of patients do respond to chemo, about 30% don't. And in those 30% who don't respond, I go on to give second line pembrolizumab. This is all based on the JAVELIN Bladder 100 phase 3 trial, which really has given us level one evidence in this area. And I think that it's been good for patients and good for us because when a patient has responded, it's nice to say, well, we're not just waiting for disease progression. We're actually doing something actively to try to limit or prevent disease progression as much as possible. And we saw, the one thing about this trial that was nice was benefits were seen regardless of whether patients got gemcitabine and cisplatin or gemcitabine and carboplatin, in patients who received 4, 5, or 6 cycles of treatment, in older patients, and regardless of the treatment-free interval from the end of chemo to the beginning of avelumab between the 4 to 10 week period that was outlined in the trial. And also importantly, avelumab did not have any detrimental impact on quality of life. And again, when we think about our patient population, tending to be a little bit older, average age about 72, often have comorbidities, often are smokers or ex-smokers, that quality of life is a really important consideration. We've seen long-term results from this study that continue to show that there were benefits observed regardless of the type of response they had, whether they had a complete, partial, or stable disease with frontline chemotherapy. And so we're sort of building on that now. There are a few trials, such as the MAINCAV trial and the Javelin Bladder Medley trial, that are trying to build on the backbone of maintenance avelumab and trying to see if we can do even better. As well, the DISCUS trial is a really interesting trial that's looking at 3 versus 6 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy. And the primary endpoint here, really interesting, is quality of life. So there's a lot going on in this space, and I think we're really doing better in terms of outcomes for our patients. So maybe we can follow up with another question, and maybe I'll ask Shilpa, for patients who have disease progression with first-line platinum-based chemotherapy, what's your recommended approach?
Ever since immunotherapy came on board, we've been fortunate to have several immunotherapy options for patients who progress on platinums, whether it's cisplatin or carboplatin-based chemotherapy. But based on level 1 evidence, pembrolizumab is our treatment of choice based on the phase 3 KEYNOTE-045 study, where second-line pembrolizumab was better and improved overall survival significantly compared to investigators' choice of chemotherapy after platinums. And in the US now, durvalumab and atezolizumab are withdrawn from this indication, but the other two immunotherapy options are avelumab or nivolumab based on phase 2 trials. But like I said, for level 1 evidence, pembrolizumab is our go-to choice. And want to bring up the targeted therapy erdafitinib for select patients who have FGFR3 alterations, fusions, or mutations. That's a very valid option. And more recently, we did answer this question about sequencing, and we found that pembrolizumab should be offered before offering erdafitinib, based on the TOR trial. So, but this is a very valid option after immunotherapy. And in practice, we like to do genetic testing for patients at the time they develop metastatic disease. The sooner the better, but that is at least we should get it so we're not scrambling at the last minute. And I'll also add that sacituzumab govitecan has, we have access to that in the US based on the accelerated approval for patients who get prior platinum immunotherapy and who've had prior enfortumab vedotin. And that's what brings me to the enfortumab vedotin, which is approved for monotherapy for patients who've had prior one-line therapy. In the past, we were using it for patients who'd had prior platinum and immunotherapy, but now the label is any one-line prior therapy, you can get enfortumab. But in the changing landscape, it's a moot point if more and more patients will get EV and pembro frontline.
Yeah, certainly a lot of options now on the table, very different than a few years ago when we didn't have a whole lot going on. And I think this speaks to really a lot of collaborations between us, industry, patient groups, scientists, really multidisciplinary approach to drug development, I think, is what we've been seeing.
Yeah.
Helen, any comments? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking out loud. You have the platinum 4 to 6 cycle, just like you. I'm veering more toward the 4-1 to save those nerves for later lines. Let's say they do well. We talked about maintenance of avelumab. They don't do well, they progress. And Shilpa just took us through a really nice list of the subsequent. What if a patient had the platinum, had the maintenance avelumab, or were deemed maybe too ill for platinum and got IO, but the immediate prior line of exposure is a mono agent IO therapy, and now they've progressed? What are you offering kind of these particular patients?
So sure. So current treatment guidelines really include several subsequent options in patients who have received both platinum-based chemotherapy and an immune checkpoint inhibitor, such as avelumab maintenance or second-line pembrolizumab. EV monotherapy is recommended treatment, of course, based on the EV-301 phase 3 trial of EV versus chemotherapy. And another option in this setting is really erdafitinib, and this is a later line option, but it's for those who have FGFR, two or three genetic alterations or mutations. So it's really important that we have the testing in place so we know the status of the patient. We recently saw results from the THOR phase 3 trial that provided level 1 evidence for erdafitinib treatment in patients with prior immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment. And, you know, a long time ago, we were doing a lot of platinum rechallenge. I don't tend to do that as much, but sometimes in someone who hasn't had platinum in a long time and they've exhausted all their other options, I may go back to it. Of course, we have to watch for neuropathy. When we look at the exploratory analysis from the Javelin Bladder 100 trial, we found that 60% of patients who received avelumab first-line maintenance went on to receive second-line treatment, with most receiving rechallenge with platinum-based chemotherapy or treatment with non-platinum-based chemotherapy, reflecting treatments available at the time the study was conducted. So there's really been a movement in terms of what's been available and what is available now compared to even a few years ago. Monotherapy with antibody drug conjugate sacituzumab govitecan, which is a TROP2 directed antibody and a topoisomerase inhibitor, is also an option for patients in some countries. So we don't have access to this in Canada, but it's a different ADC, a different antibody drug conjugate than EV. So the thinking is there's going to be non-cross resistance and non-necessarily overlapping toxicities. And some of the data for sacituzumab govitecan comes from the TROPHY-U01 trial. And then finally, in some countries, treatment with non-platinum-based chemotherapy, such as paclitaxel, docetaxel, or vinflunine, can be considered, although there's lower level of evidence. And certainly for us, you know, when we get through EV and they don't have any FGFR mutations, I do end up going back to a taxane from time to time, and I do get some responses in that context. So I think it's really showing that there's a lot of options, a lot of movement in the disease. I think biomarker testing is going to be increasingly important over time. So this brings me to the next question, which I think is really relevant to us today, and that is, does neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment affect the treatment approach for patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma? And maybe I'll ask Helen this question.
You know, I was just listening to you answering the last question. My head is whirling. Remember the day of just platinum and taxane, right? It was two options. So we flipped back and forth. And now there's just so much different sequencing, so many different moving parts. Just to add yet another moving part to this is that the idea of neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment. So a little bit different of a population. So far we've been talking about patients who are locally advanced or metastatic patients. In other words, that we're not talking so much surgery for cure, but let's back up a little bit and have that patient that you're seeing them, you think you can cure their bladder cancer by offering them a cystectomy. And generally, what would be considered the standard of care is neoadjuvant platinum-based chemotherapy or some type of, if they're eligible for it, and the same conversations we have about cisplatin eligibility applies here. And now, with the last few years, talking about do these patients go on to receive a year generally of adjuvant immunotherapy. And let's say if that patient recurs in metastatic fashion within a year, so in the middle of the IO exposure or shortly thereafter or a long time thereafter, how does that play into the selection of treatment beyond that? And the honest answer is, I don't think we 100% know, but it is a scenario that we find ourselves into more and more, right? So if I look at that patient and they have now advanced disease, they've got systemic therapy. In some ways, this is well-defined in the GYN world, the idea of platinum resistance, whether that's 6 months or 12 months, I've seen different numbers go through. So we are well aware of this in the chemotherapy the world, that if you progressed within 6 or 12 months of having received platinum, it may not be your best option to rechallenge with the same drug. Does that same idea apply for immunotherapy? What's the optimum amount of time afterwards? What if there is progression that happened in the middle of immunotherapy? And how much progression is progression? What if it's one nodule? What if it's a lot, right? So neoadjuvant treatment with cisplatin-based chemotherapy would be our standard, but that confounds subsequent treatment selection. Nivolumab is approved in some countries for patients with a high risk of recurrence and sometimes limiting to patients with PD-L1 marked tumors. And this approval of nivolumab was based on a primary endpoint, which is disease-free survival in the CheckMate 274 trial. And that's what gave us the level one evidence. However, the overall survival data is not yet, I would say, mature or available or presented. And just a few months ago at GU ASCO, we saw the third immunotherapy in this space, which is pembrolizumab in a large US-led cooperative trial by Alliance, which showed similar efficacy in disease-free survival, but yet with no positive OS data yet. So now, while we're still waiting for regulatory approval in that space, how do we sequence immunotherapy adjuvantly? No prospective trials has assessed the impact of treatment in earlier stage on the treatment of advanced disease. So in other words, what you pick up front by deciding to give neoadjuvant, by giving that 1 year of IO, how does that affect your second, third, fourth line? Of course, the hope is that you don't need to make that second or third or fourth line because that patient is cured, but we do not have high level prospective data in that space. And in clinical practice, you know, we see this 1 year talked about quite a bit. Some people would say 6 months, but 1 year, that if there is that 1 year gap between treatment, so the last IV infusion in versus noted treatment within a year, you see this defining clinical trials in practice, that the patient can be essentially treated as if they've been newly diagnosed with metastatic disease and everything we've talked about apply. But however, if they relapse within that 1 year from the end of neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment, I think a lot of us think of them more as second line, right? That cancer is really resistant or refractory to what you were treating them with, and we should really move on to a different mechanism of action in terms of drug selection. This has been the approach currently in a lot of our clinical trials. And I'm sure as more and more drugs and sequencing alters, it's going to be just a much more complicated space.
Yeah, that was really good discussion. I think, you know, the landscape has changed so much, and it's really very good to discuss this and share our thoughts. Now, to summarize, the treatment landscape for advanced urothelial cancer is evolving and will continue to evolve. The big question is, you know, how will the rest of the world be able to catch up with this new treatment regimen of EV-Pembro, which is now the standard in the U.S. already, hopefully soon in Canada and Europe. But I think the cost and the toxicity really needs to be weighed in. And, you know, just like Kala, you'd mentioned before that the DISCUS trial, you know, it's even taking a step further to see if three cycles of platinums are enough versus six. And we've already more or less adopted our practice to four cycles. I do that too. You know, the big question remains, how many cycles of EV and Pembro do you need before just doing maintenance Pembro? So I think that's a big challenge. And in my opinion, indefinite EV Pembro is just not feasible for majority of patients. And then the big question is, what is the optimal second line treatment after EV Pembro? And that's a data free zone. We know platinums will have a role there, whether sacituzumab will have a role after platinum or before platinum, we really don't know. Consequently, first line platinum based chemotherapy still remains an important option. At least I think in the rest of the world, and in the US, determining platinum eligibility has been a key consideration so far. And when platinums are used more and more in second line, I think we'll still refer to these criteria of eligibility, especially after EV, if people are even eligible, because most people do get neuropathy. And as we discussed, cisplatin and carboplatin-based chemotherapy are standard of care, followed by avelumab maintenance for patients who don't progress. And nivolumab and cisplatin-based chemotherapy just became approved in frontline setting in the US. We'll see what the rest of the world adoption will be. Split dose cisplatin is a very valid, very widely used option for patients who can't get the regular doses. And enfortumab vedotin and erdafitinib are next line options for patients who get prior platinums and immunotherapy. And sacituzumab govitecan for now, it has availability in the US, but the phase three trial for overall survival is still not read out. So I would love to hear from you, Carla, and then Helen, any parting thoughts to add something?
No, I think you covered it really nicely. Really great summary. I think all these new options are available to us. I think we're going to need to really answer these questions about how best to sequence these new treatments. And as well, are there biomarkers out there that can help us to guide what we do next? I think the other thing to keep an open mind in the metastatic setting is, can we target oligometastatic disease or oligoprogressive disease? Do we need to look at things like radiation or SBRT for that matter? That allow us to maybe extend the life of our current systemic treatments a little bit longer. So I think some of those questions are before us right now as we wait for some of the newer trials to report. And I think the changes in the landscape sometimes are going to make it tricky for ongoing trials where the current standard of care may not be the real standard of care at this time based on all the developments. So how we adjust to our clinical trial design will also be important. These are good problems to have, I reiterate, because I think we have so much we can do for our patients right now, and it's a very positive time. Helen?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, in terms of options, always amazing. I think there's still unanswered questions like you've alluded to. Sometimes I'm a little concerned that we have such an embarrassment of riches and so many options, it becomes overwhelming, and that there's an education gap there, which is probably why we're doing these podcasts, so that out in the community, there's not the sense that things are changing so fast that we don't know what we're doing. I dare to make kind of a few strong statements. I think EV plus Pembro, that survival data, that response data is really such that it really deserves that spot as one of, if not the standard care in the United States. I think that unless you have a contraindication to immunotherapy, the days of just chemotherapy without immune exposure is probably behind us, whether that's EV plus Pembro or platinum plus Nivo or platinum with maintenance of Avelumab. Somehow an immunotherapy probably need to make its way to your frontline treatment. And while head-to-head trials are not done, the idea that you would just be offered platinum alone if you can tolerate immunotherapy it should probably be reconsidered, right? And then just like what you're saying, this is not just in bladder cancer, but in a lot of cancers. What does progression mean? If there is cancer going out of control over your body, that's a totally different scenario where, than if there's one or two spots. Should it be SBRT? Should there be other novel therapy that can be considered? And also, I know Shelba alluded to FGFR. It is kind of a fruit of a lot of molecular work that we've done. But, for patients with, let's say, ERCC1, there's not that many of those patients. Should platinum still stay? Because we know they have exquisite sensitivity to platinum, right? So a lot of questions that I'm looking forward to working on the answer in the coming up years.
Thank you. This was really a great discussion.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.